Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama's gone to Copenhagen twice in the past couple of months, once to nail down the Olympics for the city of Chicago, today to settle a climate deal. Trip number one, as we know, didn't go quite so well. Trip number two, though, might have worked out a little bit better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. And by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday, the 18th of December, and it is good to have you with us. There is nothing, the saying goes, like a deadline to concentrate the mind. That has clearly been true at the UN Climate Conference in Copenhagen today. There have been rumors of some kind of deal bubbling around all day and well into the night, in fact, Copenhagen time. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been in the Danish capital the past 2 weeks for us. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
Stephen, the White House says they have reached a meaningful agreement over there. What does that mean?
Well, what it appears to mean is that rich and poor countries have agreed to list, that is, make a record of what they're pledging to do in terms of cutting emissions in the case of the rich countries, curbing emissions in the case of the poor ones, and they've agreed what they call a finance mechanism, how money will be channeled from the West to the poor countries to help them tackle climate change. And they've set a target of 2% Celsius. That's the temperature increase above which they don't want the average global temperature to rise by the end of the century.
Seems to me, then, what we have is promises and some obligations, but nothing tangible, right? I mean, we don't know where the money's coming from. We don't know what the verification methods will be, any of that.
That's absolutely right. There still appears to be no agreement on an outside system, an independent system of monitoring how the developing countries will spend the billions of dollars of financial aid that will apparently flow in their direction. We still don't know precisely where that money is going to come from, how much of it's going to come from taxpayers and how much from the private sector. And, of course, we've had this agreement on a limit to global warming of only 2 degrees Celsius, but we've had that already. The G20, which of course includes China and the US and all of Europe, they agreed that about 6 months ago.
Let's say this, though. We did get an agreement based on all the reports that we have and what you're hearing over there, where developed and developing countries sat down and said, okay, broad framework, very vague, but you know what? We are in agreement on something, yes?
Yes, and it's certainly better than nothing. But one other big disappointment, the expectation was nobody thought this was going to be a legally binding agreement, that this was going to be a treaty, but there was the expectation that by at least the end of next year, it would be turned into a legally binding treaty. Now it turns out that it could be 2 years before we get a binding treaty. And so, therefore, it means this. All this argument, all this toiling over these draft texts, all this haggling, all this waiting up until the early hours of the morning, we're going to go through this again and again for another 2 years.
So when the United Nations negotiating team wakes up on Monday morning, they will get right back into it, I imagine.
They go right back to work. This is an ongoing process, and it is going to go on until the next major UN summit in Bonn in the middle of next year, Mexico at the end of next year, and beyond into 2011.
Well, you know where you're going to be. Stephen Beard in Copenhagen for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
As Stephen and I were just saying, negotiations over global warming are going to continue for a good long while. And a lot of the concerns that various countries came to this meeting with, they're going to have the same ones in the future. Marketplace's Sam Eaton has more now from Copenhagen.
In order to really understand just how hard these negotiations have been, it may be more useful to look at what is rather than what could be. Right now, the reality is coal and oil are still what make the global economy spin. And getting us all off of it in order to keep the planet from cooking means different things to different countries.
In terms of the developing countries, it is not self-interest, it is survival.
That's Rachmat Witalar, Indonesia's lead climate negotiator.
Well, survival, meaning that one country tries to survive, the other tries to maintain its lifestyle, which I beg to suggest that the lifestyle maybe should be a bit lower. It's only lifestyle, not survival.
But for the elected leaders of the rich world, that's not exactly a message you want to bring home to your people. Mark Kinber is an economist with the London-based Climate Group.
If you're a country that is wealthy, has grown accustomed to a fairly high carbon lifestyle, you think, well, what's the hurry?
Especially when fossil fuels remain so cheap and easy. That's why rapidly growing China wants to keep using them. The last thing it wants is mass unemployment and dashed hopes for achieving an American lifestyle. But perhaps ironically, it was Thom Yorke, the lead singer of the famed rock group Radiohead, who put his finger right on the real meaning of the climate summit. He snuck into the conference with a press pass.
I'm coming here because I want to see something positive in this, because there has to be something positive in this.
Because he asks himself every time he kisses his kids goodnight what kind of world we're leaving them. In Copenhagen, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The Nasdaq provided some warmth on Wall Street today. Otherwise, things were a little cool. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Consider the Christmas tree. Douglas fir or noble, it is, in essence, a commodity. Grown, harvested, bought, and sold by the millions. Farmers in Oregon provide about a quarter of all the Christmas trees we use in this country. 7 million of them sent to big box stores and tree lots west of the Mississippi River alone. It's not exactly a recession-proof industry, but it's pretty close. Amelia Templeton reports it's all about supply and demand.
It's a week before Christmas, and Bob Schaefer is driving around the fields, figuring out what he has left to sell. Schaefer manages Noble Mountain Tree Farm, one of the largest Christmas tree suppliers in the country.
There's some drop-dead gorgeous trees out there that are not finding a home.
Schaefer supplies trees wholesale to Walmart and Home Depot. Sales are a little better than last year, but he's been forced to drop his prices 40%. He says the market is flooded with trees this year, particularly noble firs. Chal Langren is a Christmas tree specialist at Oregon State University. He's cutting down a tree for a high school fundraiser. He says that at the beginning of the decade, farmers saw the noble fir as the hot new tree.
It takes us about 8 to 9 years to grow these trees, and you can't back up the clock. So they're going to get too tall, and you just can't keep them over for the next year.
Because of the recent glut, smaller farmers, particularly newcomers, haven't been able to compete. With an oversupply of trees also predicted for next Christmas season, many are burning trees or feeding them to wood chippers in order to get something new into the ground.
We have probably somewhere around $12 invested in each tree by the time it's loaded on a truck. And there are people this year selling trees for less than that.
For shoppers west of the Mississippi, there's an upside to this story. You should be able to get a tall, fresh Christmas tree for $5 to $10 less than what you paid a few years ago. Just remember, your ceilings are probably still only 8 feet high. From Silverton, Oregon, I'm Amelia Templeton for Marketplace.
Healthcare and global warming aside, the business and economic story the past 5 days has been banks. As of this week, all the big ones have entirely given back or are in the process of giving back their bailout money. And yet not all of them are entirely healthy. Here to do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond are Heidi Moore from The Big Money. Also, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine is with us. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
I think we traveled back to last Sunday evening to begin our weekly wrap. And the president on 60 Minutes, Lee, calling bankers fat cats and all kinds of other nasty names. And then this week, you know, they go and pay back the TARP and they want to get out from under the government's thumb. Where are we with this?
Right. All the banks are now, at least all the heavies, right, are in the middle of paying back or trying to pay back their TARP money. Essentially, they just want to have their hands clean of being under the government's thumb. And a big reason to do this is so that they can be free from the Paysar's pay laws, among other things. You know, Obama is now coming out and calling the bankers fat cats, but the leverage is rapidly kind of disappearing in terms of extracting any help from the banks in terms of lending or really helping to bring the economy back.
Heidi, let me ask you this, though. And yes, it would be lovely if the banks helped out and went along with the Obama administration's plans for fixing the mortgage market and all this. But should we expect them to do any of that? I mean, they're for-profit institutions, aren't they?
They are, but they still owe their survival to the government, and they would not be here if it weren't for TARP and for a number of other government initiatives that, quite frankly, the government actually extended itself outside of its usual powers to do. So if the government could take on $2 trillion in toxic securities, the least the banks could do is hand out a few mortgages to deserving people.
Well, let me keep up with my devil's advocacy here and say, but wait a minute, I'm a shareholder in, you know, I don't know, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, whatever, and I want those guys to maximize profits, by gosh.
Well, they would have had zero profits by now because a lot of them probably would have failed without government intervention.
Lee, what do you think? You with Heidi or you with me on this one?
Well, I hate to say this, but I'm with both of you. I mean, Kai, no. Kai, you make a great point that these banks are driven by profit and profit alone. That is the only thing that drives them no matter what they say. And so if Obama was going to extract anything from them, it should have been while he had hand, which was a year ago. And when there were mandates to sort of to lend or to do more beyond what he's asking for now, which is to explore every reasonable way to help our economy move again. Well, what's reasonable to banks is to make money for themselves.
So, Heidi, where do we go from here with the banks? I mean, are we done? Are we waiting now for regulations to come out of Congress? And then that's the next time that the government gets a swipe at the banks?
In part, that's true. But the bigger problem is that Washington doesn't really want to impose any rules on the banks because the banks are profitable for Washington. They bring in a lot of donations. And in addition, they're afraid that anything that they do will hurt the banks. And then the banks will collapse or stop lending or create a future disaster in some way. So there's really kind of a tricky dynamic here where the banks think that they're strong, but they are in fact fragile. And they're using this financial reform as kind of leverage to prevent themselves from being hurt in the future. Washington is probably going to cave on that.
Yeah. All right. All of that said, let's get a little whimsical here. Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year this year. I want to play a little what if with history. If you guys could have been on that nominating committee, other than Bernanke, from the world of business and economics, Heidi, who's your person of the year?
Definitely William Poole. He's a former president of the St. Louis Fed and a man who was a visionary in terms of seeing how low interest rates got us into this mess. And in fact, he pointed out that historically, the Fed has never treated a depression or a recession with low interest rates and that the Fed should not be in the business of bailing out banks. He's a very clear-eyed person and probably the best choice.
All right. One vote for William Poole. Lee?
Well, I think Bernanke's done an admirable job, and I would defend him. But
that's not part of this game.
That's not the question. I don't know. I might say Larry Summers because, you know, he's smart. He's the brains. He's always good for something, a colorful quote. That's always fun for everybody.
To say the least.
That's right. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Heidi Moore. She's a writer for The Big Money. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, new ways to say thank you for your business.
What we're doing is we've sent out an electronic card to many of our clients and our partners in lieu of sending them a physical gift or a card and have made a donation in their honor.
First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials bumped up 20 points today, 0.2%, closed at 10,328. The NASDAQ powered up 31 points. That's almost 1.5%. Closed at 22.11. The S&P 500 ticked up 6 points. 0.5%, finished at 1102. For the week gone by, the Dow fell 1.3%. The NASDAQ rose about 1%. The S&P 500 dropped 0.33%. CarMax motored up 7% today. Darden Restaurants, the owner of Red Lobster and Olive Garden, also fattened up a 7% gain there. Boeing flew down 1.9% today after Ryanair announced it stopped negotiations to buy as many as 200 Boeing jets. Not a good thing. The major European markets all shaved off less than 1% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. And is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs, such as Marketplace Money, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. How will climate change affect where you live? Go to marketplace.org/climate and click on the map. You'll also find dramatic photos of the impact of climate change from around the world, plus all the stories from our series, The Climate Race.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund holds a Christmas tree ceremony at the Wall. Organizers will be taping greetings from the public to troops serving overseas. UPS expects to deliver 22 million packages on its busiest day of the year. And Doc, Dopey, Sleepy, Grumpy, Sneezy, Happy, and Bashful made their big screen debut in Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs on December 21, 1937. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Dow and the S&P were kind of okay today. The NASDAQ, though, put on a full 1.5%. Oracle reported a larger-than-expected increase in new software sales. And Research in Motion, they make the BlackBerry and all its variants. They reported good third-quarter results thanks to adding a lot of new customers outside North America. And it gave a strong forecast for next quarter as well. All of that has investors hopeful that businesses are finally starting to spend money again. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Corporations haven't been spending a lot of money on technology lately. Rob Enderle says Oracle's and RIM's results were surprising because no one expected companies to start spending again until next year.
Particularly with Oracle, which is a very expensive, large company vendor, the fact that they're showing strength does seem to bode well for the overall economy.
And he says it's a positive sign that the personal technology side of business spending is ticking up at the same time. Roger Kay of Endpoint Technologies says IT managers are itching to make some new investments in tech, from servers to software, and many are starting right around now. He says the news from Oracle and RIM tallies with results from companies like Intel, which has already seen an uptick in orders.
All that pattern of investment looks like business spending conditions picking up in general. And, of course, at some point that will herald a rise in employment, which will be a relief. I think that's the last stage of recovery when jobs begin to get created.
He says as they upgrade IT systems, companies are readying themselves for taking on more staff. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
For a whole lot of completely obvious reasons, 2009 was the year of the business book. There were guides to the financial crisis, what happened and who's to blame. There were how-to books and some quirky titles, too. So we asked some of our regular Marketplace commentators for a couple of their favorites from this wild year of finance.
Hi, my name is John Carney. I'm the editor of ClusterStock.com. And my favorite book of the financial crisis is Charlie Gasparino's The Sellout. I think it's a great, great take on exactly how these guys got addicted to risk-taking. And Charlie manages to thank me in the acknowledgments and list me in the index a couple times. So I like that, too.
I'm Felix Salmon of Reuters. And my book of the year, my financial book of the year, right, is The Predictable and Obvious Too Big to Fail by Andrew Ross Sorkin. It's not always the easiest or most exciting read, but it is by far the most detailed and comprehensive look at exactly what happened over the course of the worst days and weeks of the financial crisis.
Sorkin's Too Big to Fail is one of economist Paul Kodrosky's top three, mine too, actually. But Kodrosky's number one slot belongs to a different economic tome.
Best book of the year in terms of actually saying something useful that other people weren't saying about this strange adventure we've had over the last year is Reinhardt and Rogoff, Carmen Reinhardt and Ken Rogoff's book, This Time is Different, which does a really nice job of looking at 800 years of financial folly, as they call it. It's this kind of scorecard of madness of the things we've done to ourselves by blowing up our economies. And it does a really, really nice job of putting it all in context and actually giving you a sense of, you know, what might come next.
Time magazine columnist Justin Fox had his own book on financial history out this year, The Myth of the Rational Market, it's called. But he would like to draw your attention to a different one.
Lords of Finance by Liaquat Ahmed. And actually, I have to admit right here, I'm only on page 322 of 508, but I still think it's the best business book I've read this year. I'm learning so much from it because it's this history of the central bankers from the U.S., Germany, the United Kingdom, and France in the 1920s and the early 30s. And the subtitle of the book is The Bankers Who Broke the World. So the basic story is that these guys, at some level, screwed up and launched the world into the Great Depression.
I'm Angela Glover Blackwell, founder and CEO of PolicyLink. My favorite book this year was This Could Be the Start of Something Big, How Social Movements for Regional Equity Are Reshaping Metropolitan America. Pastore's book turns our old economy on its head. It shows that when we invest in all people in the region becomes a magnet for new jobs and investments. In a year filled with pessimism and economic unease, Manuel's book gave me hope that we can have a stronger, more equitable future.
Fortune magazine writer Katie Benner also gave a shout-out to Andrew Ross Sorkin's Too Big to Fail, but there is a different, unlikely business book that she suggests you pick up.
There was a book that came out in the spring called Bad Girls Go Everywhere. It was a biography of Helen Gurley Brown by Jennifer Scanlon. People would not think of this as a business book. However, what is overlooked and what Scanlon brings out is the fact that Helen Gurley Brown was so adamant about personal finance, savings, and financial independence for women. So, I mean, she might be the precursor to a Carrie Bradshaw, but also she was an early Susie Orman.
So, there you go. Enough to keep your bedside table stacked for a little while. If you want to hear a selection of some of our favorite book interviews from the past year, they're on our website. It's marketplace.org. We had Thai food for lunch the other day, right here on the company dime. The midday festivities were in lieu of a bigger, more expensive actual holiday party. It's the second year in a row that this and a whole lot of other companies have cut back. 2 years of a down economy have changed the way businesses and their employees are celebrating the season. From Chicago Public Radio, Adrienne Hill reports.
For many workers used to big bonuses and lavish holiday parties, this year could be a letdown.
Bonuses are not a guarantee.
Rosemary Hafner oversees human resources at CareerBuilder.com. A CareerBuilder survey found that less than a third of employers plan to give out bonuses this year. Instead of big checks, companies are looking for low and no-cost ways to show appreciation for their employees.
The unique ideas I've heard of is bring in your gifts and we'll wrap them for you, or we'll even do that together, give you some time, decorating contests and things that are pretty simple and in some respects may sound corny, but they're really, you know, the message they're really getting across, you know, kind of think bigger picture about the holiday season and not focus on sort of a tough year.
Natasha Fogel is an executive vice president for public relations firm Edelman. She says there won't be holiday bonuses at her company this year, but there will be gifts for employees. And right now, they're a surprise.
I'm just going to say that they're going to be pragmatic and practical in nature, not flashy televisions or things like that.
Last year, staffers got extra vacation and the chance to wear jeans to work. And staff perks aren't the only thing getting an economy-inspired makeover. Gifts to clients are changing. At Edelman, they're taking a turn to the philanthropic.
What we're doing is we've sent out an electronic card to many of our clients and our partners in lieu of sending them a physical gift or a card and have made a donation in their honor.
And there's another holiday tradition that's getting remade this year. the office party. Some places are scaling back, others are canceling parties altogether. And then there's the office party for people without an office.
I'm here at the Mid-America Club on the 80th floor of the Aon Center in downtown Chicago. The party is just getting started. And no, it's not your typical holiday party. This is a party for out-of-work Chicagoans. They're expecting 550 people here tonight, maybe more, to pack this crowded room and enjoy the party they're not going to have at work.
Well, I came to have some fun, as I no longer work with my former company. I do miss having a big party, you know.
That's out-of-work program manager Priti Gupta.
This is a great way to network and mingle with people and have some fun during holidays.
The party was organized by a group called Out of Work Chicago, and in an ironic twist, it was paid for, in part, by local corporations. In Chicago, I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This is, believe it or not, the Friday before Christmas. What better time to take a break from the big news of the week and discover what lies beneath, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Noonan, and the Marketplace staff.
Rod Abid, senior producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Charles Dickens' toothpick has just sold at auction in New York, and it sold for $9,150.
To who?
Strangely enough, the buyer does not want to be identified.
How much do you want to bet it's the guy who has George Washington's teeth?
Yeah, exactly.
Senior producer of Marketplace Money, Deb Clark, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Okay, this probably reflects my loathing of Christmas. I do everything.
Is this a bah humbug story?
Kind of. I do everything I can to avoid holiday shopping. So Walmart has a twisted idea. You can order online, which is great, right? Avoid the queues.
Sounds convenient.
And then you get to pick it up at a Walmart store.
What?
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Especially during the holidays. Why don't they just ship it to Grand Central Station?
It's like sending things to Mecca during the Hajj.
Stacey Vanek Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, President Obama this weekend is going to be appearing on a holiday wrestling special.
You're kidding.
No, he's got a message for the troops. He's going to be broadcasting.
Oh. I thought he was going to take the opportunity to, you know, work some policy issues out.
Yeah, they're going to settle this healthcare debate once and for all.
You thought you were going to take down healthcare, Joe Lieberman. Now I'm going to take down you!
The link to Rico, Brendan, and that podcast they do, it's called Dinner Party Download, is on our website. It's marketplace.org. The radio show is called Just Plain Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 20 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ packed on 31 points, almost 1.5%. The S&P 500 inched up 6 points. That is 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson, the executive producer of the program. It's a guy named J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. So, you say you want to give your true love the real 12 days of Christmas? Ooh, that's going to cost you.
You'd be paying anywhere from $240 to $600 for those laying geese.
And those ladies dancing? They get union wages, man. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back on the air Monday afternoon, regular time. Have yourself a good weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.